Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about how simple items that we can do every day can allow us to live a longer and healthier life. And then we're going to talk about the environment. I'm going to give you the latest on everything happening there. We're also going to look at how we could save at least 50% on all of the infrastructure cost in the United States in the upcoming future. We know we have to rebuild our infrastructure. We have to rebuild our inner cities. It is not fair to the poor people and the working class people to be living in poverty. So how can we help them without it bankrupting us or being used as an excuse? Well, it's too expensive. It's not too expensive. I'll explain that. And from our audio clip file today, we're going to look at several issues, and I'm going to open these up for talkback, meaning you have an opportunity to call in and share your points of view. I want to show how we should go to the progenitor, to the beginning of an issue, to understand its most recent extended manifestation. For example, we're all talking about, should we build the pipeline or not through Indian land? Well, why don't we go back and look at the fact we stole this land and we had treaties, over 500 treaties. We broke every single treaty. Shouldn't we begin there if we were ethical, honorable, decent, and had real character to say we should honor our word and our treaties? And therefore, if they don't want this pipeline going across their land, they shouldn't have it. Or what would happen if we decided to put a pipeline through, let's say, Arlington Cemetery under our fallen soldiers' graves? How do you think that would go? Why should a Native American's burial grounds be any less sacred and important to them? So I'm going to share that with you. And then, why are more and more people protesting what is happening with Donald Trump? Rightly so, and I support that protest. But why aren't they also protesting against the abuse of women in other countries, especially our allies? I'll play a clip on that. I think you'll find it revealing. The way we've handled the entire immigration issue, in my opinion, is wrong. And I believe that we have not done it in a humane way, intelligent way, and we've done it by ideology, by fear, and by misunderstanding. But why are we having one set of issues where we're angry at Trump, and rightly so, but we're not angry at Bill Clinton? Clinton said the same identical thing as Trump, and he got a standing ovation in Congress during his State of the Union speech. Think not? I'll play the speech. I found the clip. And also, if we're angry about what is happening with immigration, why are we not also angry at countries that refuse to take any immigrants at all? Not one. And I have a particular commentary I'm going to share on that I wrote early this morning, because it shows you either the lack of depth of awareness, a lack of care, or lack of knowledge about what's really going on in the world. So, you see, we have a lot to share today. Let's begin. First up, I've mentioned maybe 300 or 400 times why we should be having turmeric, T-U-R-M-E-R-I-C, into our diet. Now, you can have curry, and that's good, but that's not really medicinal. You would have to eat far too much curry. And because it's really not the curry itself, and it's not the turmeric itself, it's a component of the turmeric, a fraction of it called curcumin. That is beneficial, especially when you're around 500 milligrams to 1,000 milligrams. It's really good for you. And if you have cancer and other conditions that are pro-inflammatory, like the brain conditions, then it starts at like 2,000, goes to 7,000 milligrams. Here is the latest on this, and this was published in Diabetes Care, which is the Journal of the American Diabetic Association. They found in a remarkable human clinical study that turmeric extract was 100% successful at preventing pre-diabetic patients from becoming diabetic over the course of 9-month intervention. Wow, think of that. Now, we have not an epidemic, we have a pandemic. We have a tsunami of pre-diabetic and diabetic conditions in the United States. How many? Over 100 million. That's approaching 1/3 of the population. So that means that those people are going to adversely be affected. Even just yesterday, there was someone who has end-stage renal failure, has gone blind, all because of diabetes. And I was intervening to see if I could help them. And it's amazing when you speak with someone and you ask them, well, you have given up sugars. No. You gave up pastas and bread. No. Did your doctors tell you to give all this up? Well, the dietitian put me on a diet, but it contained these things, but just in smaller amounts. So what about juicing and exercise? No. It's hard to imagine that there's not better advice given, because diabetes is one of the easiest diseases to cure and one of the simplest to prevent. So here is where they had 100% success in preventing pre-diabetes from becoming diabetes just by adding one single ingredient. And that's not even adding exercise twice a day, 40 minutes, to help maintain blood sugar. And this was performed by Thailand researchers, and it was the efficacy of curcumin, the primary polyphenol in turmeric, which gives the spice its golden hue. And that's what delayed the development of type 2 diabetes mellitus. So this was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, and it worked. Published in a peer-reviewed journal, done at a good institution. So no longer can your physician or anyone else say, well, one ingredient can't make a difference. Yeah, it can, and it did, and there's the proof of it. Now, what about the prickly pear? Interesting, because this week when I was out doing a workout, I ran by a prickly pear. It was just in bloom, and it was my prickly pear, so I didn't stop, and I grow prickly pears, and I didn't stop and take it, but I was thinking about what happens when you cut off the ends. And by the way, a prickly pear, you can buy them, they're in season now. You can buy them in a store. But don't just pick them up with your hands, because little tiny, hair-thin spikes will go into your fingers and your hands. Instead, take a rubber glove or a double-folded napkin and hold it that way. Then you cut the ends off and just peel it back. Now, what you're left with inside is a red little orbs, kind of, the flesh is red, though I've seen yellow flesh as well, but the flesh is red and very tasty, and then there's little tiny emerald-colored, ruby-colored orbs, and that's what's got the nutritional value. So these are terrific for you. Plus, they found in this study from the University of Malta, as well as University of Bordeaux in France, that prickly pears and seaweed are great for your brain. Extracts from prickly pear and brown seaweed, because there's many different colors, there's white seaweed, yellow seaweed, orange seaweed, green seaweed, but brown is the one that can help prolong the life of people with Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease by disrupting toxic compounds. That's according to the research. And researchers from these two areas, Malta and France, fed extracts of the plants to transgenic flies engineered to express both late and early onset Alzheimer's disease as well as Parkinson's, along with the non-modified flies. And while the prickly pears and seaweed extracts had no benefit on normal flies, the researchers found the extracts could improve both factors for the transgenic flies compared to controls. So what this means is that if you're taking these compounds in, much like black tea, which does the same thing, they impact genetic sequencing. They impact the expression of how things cause Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. For example, the test to test the effectiveness of the extracts of on disrupting the action of a what is called AP42 and ASIN oligomers, which cause the expression of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, it had an impact. So anything that can block a disease that is natural, non-toxic, is good. And green tea, black tea, white tea, oolong tea, prickly pears, and brown seaweed are all capable of blocking this, which means that they can help a person with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. Now, from the Silent Spring Institute up in Newton, Massachusetts, they did some research, and they found that the fast food packaging contains some harmful chemicals that can leach into the food. Why is this important? Because many Americans, since the beginning of the new year, will resolve to cut back on fast foods, hopefully to avoid mainly a lot of fat and calories and sugars. Yet there's another good reason to resist the temptation to indulge in fast foods. The grease-proof packaging holding your burger and fries can contain potentially harmful chemicals that can leach into the food. And that's according to a new peer-reviewed study. Now, in the most comprehensive analysis to date on the prevalence of highly chemicalized paper in fast food packaging in the United States, researchers tested more than 400 samples from 27 fast food chains throughout the United States. The samples consisted of paper wrappings, paperboard, and drink containers, and they were analyzed for a class of chemicals called PFASs, and these are the per- and polyfluoroalkyline substances, or known as PFCs. And these highly chemicalized properties are widely used in an array of non-stick, stain-resistant, and waterproof products, including carpeting, cookware, outdoor apparel, like the jackets and the ski materials, as well as food packaging. Quote from the study, "These chemicals have been linked with numerous health problems, so it's concerning that people are potentially exposed to them in food. And children are especially at risk for health effects because their developing bodies are more vulnerable to toxic chemicals," end quote. This was published in the Journal of Environmental Science and Technology Letters. So, okay, you can say, well, gee whiz, can't they make a safer packaging for junk food? Now, think of the oxymoron there. That's like saying, surely they can make a safer bottle to put the arsenic in. Why not just give up the fast foods? And finally today, cruciferous vegetables help the immune system to fight intestinal pathogens. This is from the Francis Crick Institute. A study showed that eating cruciferous vegetables in this laboratory experiment, including broccoli and kale and cauliflower, helps the immune system to fight intestinal pathogens. And the research has strong implications for inflammatory bowel diseases. The protein called anal hydrocarbon receptor plays a crucial role in protecting us from external pollutants and toxins and pathogens. And so the cruciferous vegetables help block these pathogens. So when you're having your broccoli or your cauliflower, just remember you're doing something really good for your intestines. And by the way, from the Kyoto University in Japan, vitamin D was discovered to prove a key in new treatments. So they're being able to use vitamin D to treat all forms of diseases now. And that's a good thing. Of course, if you took that, that would be terrific. And I get a lot of calls of people who suffer from atrial fibrillation after cardiac surgery. that's an irregular heartbeat and that can lead to stroke. And of course, I generally suggest a protocol of magnesium twice a day, cayenne twice a day, Q10, L-carnitine, hawthorn, and also Ajuna. And all of these are extremely good at regulating heartbeats. So I've gotten a lot of positive feedback of people who have irregular heartbeats, and this was able to help tremendously and many times reverse it. Now, according to University of Helsinki, which is in Finland, there's another nutrient, vitamin C. That's correct. Vitamin C may decrease the risk of AFib after cardiac surgery. Now, AFib is a common cardiac rhythm disturbance that can lead to severe consequences like stroke and heart failure, but it can be triggered by various stressful conditions, and about 30% of patients undergoing cardiac operations suffer from postoperative AFib, or people getting general anesthetics for any condition can suffer from it. And by the way, there's one other way, excessive training. You can also suffer from it. So I get a lot of athletes, including vegan athletes, who say, how in the world did I end up getting, you know, AFib? I'm this, I'm that, and the other. I said, well, do you do normal training? Or do you do excessive training? Well, I'm training for a marathon. That's excessive training. And unless you've compensated, you run a risk. About 20 to 25% of all athletes doing excessive training run the risk of AFib. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a short break and come right back. Please stay with us. For all of you listening all over the world, plus all of our syndicated stations, plus over the internet, plus over the telephones, plus listening on the download on archives, and we want to thank you for passing on the information one to another. Google Progressive Radio, we're number one in the world. Take a look at Zeno Radio, we're the number one listened to over the telephone in the world of 10,000 stations, including topping Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, Michael Savage, Alex Jones, and Sean Hannity. We have more people listening right now over the telephone and downloading over the phone, plus downloading regularly. So to the 253 million people who visited our site last year, that's a lot of people, we're providing all the articles, hundreds every week on women's health issues, environmental health issues, anti-aging issues, positive things that empower people. And we're going to keep doing it every single day. In about, 20 minutes from now, we'll have our guest on. And our guest is a doctor. The doctor is going to be Nargan, who is the Regulatory Policy Advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch. And we're going to talk about the GOP Congress evoking the Congressional Review Act to further enable Donald Trump's deregulation frenzy. So we're going to keep you in the loop on that. But right now, I want to share some clips with you. And we're going to start with the whole idea that why don't we go back and honor the treaties we have with Native Americans, because we stole their land, and we've never honored a treaty, and we killed between 50 to 100 million of them, and that's the greatest genocide in history. That is a greater genocide than Stalin and Lenin combined, or Mao, Hitler, and Stalin combined. And we never discuss it as if, well, that was it was yesterday, let it go. It doesn't matter how long ago any form of human rights abuse occurred. We should not allow it to happen today, and we're doing it today by not honoring them.
A state many people don't actually believe exists has become the latest battlefield in the ongoing war between Native peoples and big oil.
Well, Native American tribes from both North and South Dakota are in Washington, D.C. now protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Now, as uncomfortable as it is to think about, it's worth remembering that this country was basically built on the back of a genocide of the Native Americans. We came, we stole their land, and then we killed off the vast majority of them. The ones we didn't kill, we signed a bunch of treaties with, and then proceeded to simply ignore them. And by a bunch, I mean literally over 500. Fine, we did give them the reservations, but reservations is just a nicer sounding word for the shittiest land that we didn't really want. And as if that wasn't enough, we're now trying to build a giant oil pipeline through part of their sacred land in North Dakota. That land was given to them as part of an 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. Naturally, the U.S. government just took it back 9 years later. The pipeline will also cut through 200 rivers, creeks, and tributaries, carrying 570,000 barrels of oil a day. Now, considering the fact that July was the hottest month ever recorded ever, we should be weaning ourselves off of fossil fuels, not making it easier to consume more oil. The Native Americans who are protesting the construction of this pipeline are actually doing the work that all of us should be doing. And this has been part of a larger trend around the world. Indigenous protests have been at the forefront of the environmental battle against fossil fuels. Native people protested the expansion of the tar sands in Canada and the Keystone Pipeline here in the United States. And in Ecuador, it was indigenous people that helped bring a multi-billion dollar lawsuit against Texaco and Chevron over oil pollution.
Listen to our cries, because our indigenous people are suffering to protect the land that you are living on.
In North Dakota, the protesters claim that the pipeline would risk polluting the Missouri River, which they consider sacred. And their fears seem to be well-founded. Back in 2010, a pipeline burst near the Kalamazoo River in Michigan, dumping over 1 million gallons of oil into the river. The cleanup took years, cost over $1 billion, and the Kalamazoo River may never be the same. Recently, in Ventura, California, a pipeline spilled hundreds of barrels of oil, affecting the local wildlife. It was the second spill there since 2008, when over 200,000 barrels spilled, and 50,000 gallons spilled into the Yellowstone River last year. So yeah, this kind of thing happens all the time. There's a section in the National Historic Preservation Act requiring federal agencies to take into account the effects of their undertakings on historic property. Basically, before the government allows them to build a pipeline like this, they have to make sure that the land doesn't have some sort of cultural significance. Like, they would never build a pipeline through Monticello or Plymouth Rock or the Alamo or something. It's a total violation of the law, which emphasizes consultation with the tribes. Quote, consultation with an Indian tribe must respect tribal sovereignty and the government-to-government relationship between the federal government and Indian tribes. Now a judge is set to decide whether this pipeline violates the law. But let's face it, it wouldn't be the first time we conveniently ignored the law to screw over the Native Americans and the environment.
And we should consider today going back to the original treaties and holding all Native American land as sacred and sovereign land for them and not to be exploited. At the same time, one of the legislators, a Republican from Utah, is passing a law that will allow 3.3 million acres of our national forest to be turned over to the states for privatization, meaning we could have oil drilling, gas hydrofracking, pollution of our national commons, our parks. We shouldn't allow that. But if it was done in secret, we wouldn't know it. And a lot of this is being done in secret. There's not a lot of public discussion and almost nothing in the media about it. So let's be aware. We'll keep you abreast of all of these kind of secret policies that are going through. And now let's go over to Washington, because I'm sure we can become even more enlightened on this topic. My guest is standing by. He is Dr. M. Narang. He is the Regulatory Policy Advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. He's an expert on the federal regulatory process, and he's testified before Congress on legislation and issues related to the executive branch's administration of the rulemaking process and congressional oversight of federal agencies. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
I want to preface our conversation by reading a paragraph of the text on Public Citizen's website that introduces the Congressional Review Act so listeners better understand the problem at hand and your comments. It's short. Quote, the Congressional Review Act allows Congress to strike down regulations issued in the final months of the last administration using expedited procedures. As a result, Hundreds of health, safety, pocketbook, and environmental protections are in danger of being repealed, and we won't be able to get them back anytime soon. If these rules are repealed, corporate predators, polluters, pickpockets will be free to abuse, exploit, and discriminate against American workers, consumers, and families, knowing they won't be held accountable, end quote. And I'd like just to add that these regulations involve clean air and energy conservation, greenhouse gas emissions, oil and gas operations, anti-corruption rules, paid sick leave and child care, waste management, many Medicare programs, education, and much more. And right now, the Republicans have a commanding lead of legislators in the House and the small 52% minority in the Senate. So we are potentially looking at a critical cascade of rollbacks on regulations in place to protect consumers and the public and will only benefit corporations and private interest in the long term. So please explain further this Review Act. And is this being pushed by the Trump administration now, or is it an initiative coming from within the congressional GOP? And secondly, does this have anything to do with Trump's decree that for every new regulation, we will eliminate two others?
Okay, great. So let me start with the Congressional Review Act. It's a law that is not very well known because it hasn't been used that often. It was passed by the Republican Congress under Newt Gingrich in the mid-90s. Essentially what it does is it allows Congress to overturn regulations that are just finalized on a majority basis as long as the president signs it. So that's a key feature right there, majority basis. That means that in the Senate, there's no filibuster and there's no way for Democrats to hold the line against these votes, against these rollbacks. It's just a simple majority vote. And so obviously for the incoming GOP Congress, this is kind of one of their first action items because it's a politically effective tool for them. Of course, the public pays the price. As you're indicating, these are regulations that are critical to protecting the public, to holding Wall Street accountable, to making sure consumer products are safe, financial products aren't ripping off consumers, making sure that we don't have discrimination in the workplace, that our workplaces are safe, that our food is safe. It just cuts across all of the areas where, of course, corporations want to cut corners and make profits and externalize costs onto the public. But we need protections to make sure that that these costs aren't being shifted onto the public and the public isn't being exposed to risks that cost lives and cost money, cost consumers money and cost our economy money when deregulation goes off the rails like it did in the lead up to the Wall Street financial crash about 8 years ago. That financial crash is the reason that our economy has struggled over the last 8 years, and it also definitely proves that claiming that regulation is a job killer is completely false. That's what the Republicans like to say. In fact, the very opposite is true. The costs of not regulating are what end up making Americans pay the price the most. And unfortunately, I think there's some amnesia about just what the effects of not regulating are. So these Congressional Review Act challenges have already begun. The House has already taken up a couple of different regulations that they want to roll back. One would protect streams from toxic pollution from nearby mining operations, especially mountaintop mining removal, which in and of itself is, a horrible way of mining coal. But it also has the secondary impact of polluting streams when all of the toxic coal dust and coal ash finds its way into the streams at the bottom of those mountains. And then, of course, that pollutes rivers and bigger water bodies downstream. the coal industry is not like this rule. They say that it kills jobs. Those same coal executives also say to Trump, don't make too much of bringing back coal jobs. The industry is losing jobs, not because of regulation, but because of market forces, the move to cleaner fuels, and hopefully eventually to entirely fossil-free sources of clean energy. Even Senator McConnell from Kentucky, who has very strongly pushed rolling back this rule, has publicly admitted that the rule will not bring back coal jobs. This is all a farce in order to allow the GOP Congress to try to give a quick win to their big oil and gas and coal campaign donors. And we're going to see this play out with every rule they roll back in the beginning of this Congress.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. For myself, and I'm sure many of our listeners right now, two of the more important areas are the state of the environment and healthcare. And since these are two topics we address frequently on this program, I'm interested in your insight, because when it comes to the environment and tackling climate change, the United States is already way behind the curve to move towards any semblance of sustainability. And when it comes to healthcare over corporate profits, we also are way behind other modern nations that actually value human life and the quality of health of its population. So what is Public Citizen now observing as being the more important regulations and rules concerning the environment and healthcare that are most likely to be on the chopping blocks? And what do you foresee as the long-term consequences if these regulations are eliminated?
Sure. So on the environmental end, the Congressional Review Act can only be used to go back to rules that were finalized near the end of the Obama administration from about last June on. Fortunately, that means that there are many environmental measures, including the climate change regulations that the EPA did, that can't just be killed by this Congress through the Congressional Review Act. Instead, it's looking likely, given who President Trump has picked for the EPA, somebody named Scott Pruitt, who basically doesn't believe that there's any federal role in protecting the environment, that states should just be left to do whatever they want, no matter that, you know, air pollution, clean water pollution, and, of course, the existence of climate change does not know state borders, crosses state borders. It's a federal, national, obviously even global issue at this point. This individual is probably going to want to turn back the clock as much as possible at the EPA, and I imagine in one way or the other will try to make sure that the climate change regulations also are killed. There's a couple of different ways they could do that. They could stop trying to defend those regulations in court. They've been challenged by big oil and gas, and they could stop trying to defend those regulations. That could mean that the regulations end up disappearing, essentially. That is a little bit tougher than because environmentalists can come in and say, actually, we're going to take up the defense of this important regulation for the environment. The other way to do it is basically to go through the same process that the Obama EPA went through to put the climate change regulations in place in the first place. That's a long process. It involves lots of analysis. Lots of kind of procedural requirements that they have to go through in order to make sure they do it in a legally sound way. And frankly, it's not easy to basically say the exact. It's not easy for the Trump EPA to say, you know, the exact opposite of what the Obama EPA said. The EPA under Obama said climate change is important. It will benefit the public. It will be greater than the cost to the oil and gas and coal industry. And there is reams of science that support the EPA regulating carbon emissions to combat climate change. the Trump, you know, under Trump, the EPA is going to have to try to come up with reasons. I don't think this is going to be easy to indicate why science, why climate science, actually points in the direction of not limiting carbon emissions, not regulating carbon emissions, and not trying to combat climate change. That may be hard for the EPA to do, and even if they're able to do it, if it looks like it's suspicious or not really based on good analysis, that could be a problem for them in court. But it does also, you know, it would also be a feature of what Trump has called, you know, overregulation in the United States in his attempt to try to axe, I think he said 75% to 80% of regulations. This is another one of the outlandish campaign promises that Trump made that has no chance of occurring. There is a new executive order, as you've mentioned, that requires two regulations to be removed or killed in order for any agency under Trump to actually put forward a new regulation. Maybe that'll be a vehicle for trying to kill climate change. But again, they're going to run into some kind of legal obstacles and some technical obstacles that may be pretty significant for them. And then, of course, there's the important point of the public being very supportive of climate change, being very, very supportive of regulations that protect the environment, combat pollution in air and water. And Trump is going to have to try to deal with that. I don't think the public opinion is going to be in his favor.
I would agree.
On the healthcare end, let me touch quickly on the healthcare. I think trying to reduce drug prices will be one way in which Trump can attack you know, the problems in our healthcare system. That's really the only way in which he's indicated that he'll actually enact any kind of good policy in our eyes when it comes to healthcare. It does not look like he's going to fulfill that promise. Just yesterday, I think he met with a group of big pharmaceutical company lobbyists, and he basically told them, I'm going to do exactly what you want me to do, which is cut your taxes and deregulate the pharmaceutical industry. So I don't think he's going to fulfill that campaign promise, and I expect the public to hold him accountable.
Well, Mae West would hold him accountable. Remember Mae West, the old Hollywood actress? Was that before your time?
It may have been a little bit before my time. I think she's got some disciples in Hollywood, though, probably.
She does. It was Mae West who said his mother should have thrown him away and kept the stork. In any case, Amit, thank you for being with us today.
I don't know if his mother is still around, probably, to regret that. Maybe.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. From Public Citizen, Dr. Amit Narang. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. And now I'd like to share some insights from Professor Ellen Brown. All of us know that we need to improve the quality of our infrastructures. I've had the great privilege in my lifetime to drive back and forth across America. I'm always out filming, and when I was filming most recently, and I was Colorado and Montana and Wyoming and Utah and a lot of other states. When you're driving through these communities, you get a chance to see the bridges, the tunnels. You get to see their infrastructure. And then, of course, when you speak with people, you hear people in Flint, Michigan saying, look at our water. But it's not just Flint. All across America, our infrastructures, our dams, our levees, they're challenged, they're corroding, they're breaking down. In no small measure because we have not made it a national policy to try to make it all work. I happen to believe that what we need and could do easily is to look at what the Germans, the French, the Japanese, and the Chinese have done as far as high-speed trains. In fact, there are now high-speed trains that are running without any polluting fuel at all. They're completely green, and they're very fast. you're looking at more than 2 to 3 times the speed of our trains. So just imagine if you wanted to go from New York to Los Angeles or New York to Chicago or Chicago to Houston and you didn't have to fly or you didn't have to drive. Now imagine how much that would be as far as lessening your carbon footprint. It would be tremendous. Now with all the great minds in America, especially all the technologists, we could very easily come up with a whole new generation. I'm very confident of that. And if we did like a Marshall Plan for the environment, it would help lessen global warming and many of the causes of it. But the sticking point is not, do we have the bright minds? Do we have the capacity to create wonderful infrastructure, green infrastructure, helping entire communities go green in California, Texas, Arizona, Nevada, Florida? Oh, yeah, we could... We could subsidize low-cost infrastructure that includes putting green solar panels on people's homes. And that would save all that extra electricity, which is a very, you know, coal was used in a lot of power plants, and it would help prevent that. The problem is the expense, especially when you have a government that does what is known as private-public partnerships. Now, I mentioned recently on a program talking about New Orleans that when I was down there right after Katrina, you would see people up on roofs stapling in or nail gunning in tarpons. And sometimes they would cover most of a roof, start with one side, go clear over the other. Others were smaller patches. Most, I'm guessing, were about 20-foot by 20-foot patches. Now, you could go to a store and you could buy yourself one of these tarpons, and then you could get some caulking material, some of that black tar that goes on as a paint and then morphs within about 3 hours into a rubber that is leak-proof. Maybe you're talking about $100, $150. But then you start to realize the government was being charged per tarp, per roof, by a general contractor that had given a lot of money to the Bush administration, approximately $175 per square foot. Now, let's say you have a 20 by 20, that's 400 square feet. So 400 square feet times $175, you're dealing with an astronomical amount. That's more, to put one little tarp on, it's amazing. It's $70,000. And you're thinking, that's more than what the house is worth for a tarpon, and that just went to the general contractor, and then from the general contractor, they didn't do any of it. That went to a subcontractor, and the subcontractor was getting the tarpon free. It was just the $2 a square foot they were paying to the person who actually did the work. And so three different hands touch the money. And that's generally what happens with most of these private-public contracts. It's always the insiders. It's always major corporate donors who have that. Now, here's what Ellen Brown says that we could do to cut back on the expenses. Here's what she says. Quote, President-elect Donald Trump has promised to rebuild America's airports, bridges, tunnels, roads, and other infrastructure, something both Democrats and Republicans agree should be done. The country needs a full $3 trillion in infrastructure over the next decade. The $1 trillion plan revealed by Trump's economic advisors relies heavily upon public-private partnerships, and private equity firms are lining up for these plumbing investments. In the typical private equity water deal, for example, higher user rates help the firms earn annual returns of up to 18%, more than a regular for-profit water company might expect. But the price tag can come as a rude surprise for local ratepayers. Private equity investments now generate an average return of about 11.8% annually on a 10-year basis. And for infrastructure investments, those profits are made on tolls and fees paid by the public. Even a simple interest that puts the cost to the public of financing $1 trillion in infrastructure projects at $1.8 trillion, more than doubling the cost. Cities often make these desperate deals because they're heavily in debt and the arrangement can give them cash up front. But at a Government Accountability Office report warned, quote, there is no free money in public-private partnerships, and the local residents wind up picking up the tab. And there is more cost-effective alternative. The conservative state of North Dakota is funding infrastructure through the state-owned Bank of North Dakota at 2% annually. The North Dakota legislature established the Bank of North Dakota Infrastructure Loan Fund that made $50 million in funds available to communities with a population of less than 2,000 and $100 million available to communities with a population greater than 2,000. These loans have a 2% fixed interest rate and a term of up to 30 years. The proceeds can be used for the new construction of water and treatment plants, sewer and water lines, transportation infrastructure, and other infrastructure needs to support new growth in a community. If the Trump $1 trillion infrastructure plan were funded at 2% over 10 years, the interest tab would come to only $200 billion, not $1 trillion, less than the $1.18 trillion expected by private equity investors. Now think of that for a moment. If we did it Ellen's way, we'd only be paying 2% interest, and over 10 years that would be $200 billion. But if we do it Trump's way, we're going to pay the private equity firms $1 trillion, $180 billion in profits. That's ridiculous. So not only could the American taxpayer save $1 trillion over years on tolls and fees, but they could save on taxes since the interest would return to the government, which owned the bank. In effect, the loans would be nearly interest-free to the government. Legislators and cash-strapped communities are likely to object. Well, we can't afford to lend out our revenues. We need them for our budget. But banks do not lend their deposits. They actually create new money in the form of bank credit when they make loans. That means borrowing from its own bank is not just interest-free to the local government, but actually creates new money for the local economy. So that's a positive solution. And we thank Ellen Brown for sharing it. In the last segment of our program today, I want to go to, I think, a very important set of statements by a group of women. All of these women have something in common. They're all Muslim. They're fully immersed in their belief, their religious belief, but they also are activists. These are feminists from different countries, all who've experienced the shaming, the honor beatings. They've experienced honor killings in people they know. And they're speaking out. And I believe that American feminism, and even those who have not yet expressed their desire to unite with those, could do several things. One of them that could be done immediately is start to form demonstrations in front of the Saudi Arabian, Kuwaitian, United Arab Emirate, Bahrainian embassies in Washington, D.C., to look at the products that these countries export to the United States and boycott them, and then to bring forth documentaries. There's a really terrifying documentary that was done undercover in Saudi Arabia, which I watched recently, that showed what it's like there if you're a woman. And then that doesn't even take into account if you're a Shia woman, which is a minority which are persecuted, or you don't come from a royal family, of how you're treated. And so we could do a lot. And then on tomorrow's program, I'm going to give a list of maybe 50 suggestions of what women can do, uniting with small groups on positive change that will help all women, not just yourself and the women in your group, but it sets a standard that can be used throughout the world. Here are some of these people now talking about this.
Culture matters. It's the primary source of social progress or regression. Nowhere do we see this more clearly than in the status of women. The Judeo-Christian culture and perhaps a more upward civilization has produced over time the law codes, language, and material prosperity that have greatly elevated women's status. But this progress is not shared everywhere. There are still hundreds of millions of people that live in a culture, the Islamic, for instance, that takes female inferiority for granted. Until recently, these cultures, the Western and the Islamic, were for the most part separated. But that is changing, dramatically so. Large numbers of immigrant men from the Middle East, South Asia, and various parts of Africa have brought a different set of values to the West, specifically Europe. More than 1 million arrived in 2015 alone. More are on the way. As a result, crimes against girls and women, groping, harassments, assaults, and rape have risen sharply. These crimes illustrate the stark difference between the Western culture of the victims and that of the perpetrators. Let me be clear. Not all immigrant men, or even most, indulge in sex attacks or approve of such attacks. But it's a grave mistake to deny that the value system of the attackers is radically different from the value system of the West. In the West, women are emancipated and sexually autonomous. Religiosity and sexual behavior or sexual restraint is determined by women's individual wishes. The other value system is one in which women are viewed as either commodities, that is, their worth depends on their virginity, or on the level of a prostitute if they're guilty of public immodesty, wearing a short skirt, for example. I do not believe these value systems can coexist. The question is which value system will prevail. Unfortunately, this remains an open question. The current situation in Europe is deeply troubling. Not only are Muslim women within Europe subject to considerable oppression in many ways, such norms now risk spreading to non-Muslim women who face harassment from Muslim men. One would think that Western feminists in the United States and Europe would be very disturbed by this obvious misogyny. But sadly, with few exceptions, this does not appear to be the case. Common among many Western feminists is a type of moral confusion in which women are said to be oppressed everywhere, and that this oppression, in feminist Eve Ensler's words, is exactly the same around the world, in the West, just as in Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. To me, this suggests too much moral relativism and an inadequate understanding of Sharia law. It is true that the situation for women in the West is not perfect, but can anyone truly deny that women enjoy greater freedom and opportunities in the United States, France, and Finland than they do in Iran, Pakistan, or Saudi Arabia? Other feminists have also argued that non-Western women do not need saving and that any suggestion that they need help from Western feminists is insulting and condescending to non-Western women. My perspective is a practical one. Any efforts that help Muslim women, whether they live in the West or under Islamic governments, should be encouraged. Every effort to pressure these governments to change unjust laws should be supported. Western feminists and female Western leaders have a simple choice to make. Either excuse the inexcusable or demand reform in cultures and religious doctrines that continue to oppress women. Nothing illustrates this better than what happened in Cologne, Germany on New Year's Eve 2015. That night, during the city's traditional celebrations, numerous German women, 467 at the last count, reported being sexually harassed or assaulted by men of North African and Arab origin. Within 2 months, 73 suspects had been identified, most of them from North Africa. 12 of them have been linked to sexual crimes. Yet, in response to the attacks, Cologne's feminist mayor Henriette Reker issued an arm's-length guideline to women. Just keep an arm's-length distance between you and a mob of Arab men, she advised Cologne's female population, and you will be fine. Mayor Reker's comments underline the seriousness of the problem. A culture clash is upon us. The first step in resolving it is to unapologetically defend the values that have allowed women to flourish. Feminists with their organizations, networks, and lobbying power need to be on the front lines of this battle. Their relevance depends on it. And so does the well-being of countless women, Western and non-Western. I'm Ayan Hirsi Ali of Harvard University for Prager University.
And that is a very important voice to show what can be done within a religion to those who take some positions that are against the actual religion but are kept within the common culture, the men. So think of all the women around the world who are suffering, who do not have 1% of the freedoms and privileges that American women have. And for all the women in America who are seeking to right injustices in our own society, continue those charges, continue to petition, continue to demonstrate. It is important, but please do not turn your back on the women of Saudi Arabia or these other countries. If anyone from the United States, any woman from the United States, except maybe a Hillary Clinton, if you went there and tried to organize any protest whatsoever, you'd be arrested. You could also be killed. They have no right of assembly, no right of dress, no right of driving a car, no right of voting. They have no rights at all, except what the men in power choose to give them. That's not freedom. That's misogyny. And so we support a unified cause for all women throughout the world to engage in equality as the men would have. More on that on upcoming programs. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen today, and we look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.